Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're jumping into Betts v. Brady.
1942, a really pivotal Supreme Court case.
Yeah, pivotal, because it set the stage for, well, for how states handled the right to counsel for indigent defendants for about 20 years, right? Before Gideon came along.
Exactly. Before Gideon v. Wainwright completely changed the landscape.
So for the law students listening, this case is crucial.
Yeah.
It really gets into how the Bill of Rights, specifically the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, applies or didn't apply to the states through the 14th Amendment.
And it highlights that classic tension, doesn't it, between, you know, state autonomy and what we consider fundamental fairness in the justice system.
Definitely. The core issue revolves around a man named Smith Betts. He was charged with robbery in Maryland, couldn't afford a lawyer.
And Maryland law back then only provided state-funded lawyers in capital cases. So murder, treason, things like that.
And robbery.
Right.
So the court denied his request for counsel. He had to represent himself.
Which leads to the central question the Supreme Court tackled. Does the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause require states to provide lawyers in all criminal cases, even non-capital ones?
A huge question.
Oh. Wait,
let's maybe back up a bit. Tell us more about the specifics of Betts' situation.
Sure. So this was 1941. Smith Betts, described as a farmhand, is charged with robbery in Carroll County, Maryland. He appears for his arraignment, tells the judge he's indigent.
Meaning he has no money for a lawyer.
Right. And he asks the judge to appoint one for him. The judge says no, citing that Maryland rule counsel only for capital offenses like murder or rape at the time.
So Betts is facing a serious felony, potentially years in prison, and he's on his own legally.
Completely on his own. Now, it's worth noting he did actually try to mount a defense. He pleaded not guilty. He cross-examined the state's witnesses when they testified.
Okay, so he didn't just stand there silently.
No, he participated. He even called his own witnesses to try and establish an alibi, but, you know, without legal training.
It's a tough situation. Unsurprisingly, he was convicted.
He was. Convicted of robbery and sentenced to 8 years in the Maryland penitentiary.
8 years. Did he challenge the conviction based on the lack of counsel?
He did. He believed his trial was fundamentally unfair because he didn't have a lawyer. So he filed petitions for a writ of habeas corpus in the Maryland state courts.
Arguing his 14th Amendment due process rights were violated.
Exactly. But the Maryland courts, including the state's highest court, denied his petitions. They basically upheld the trial judge's decision based on existing Maryland law and precedent.
So the state courts essentially said, no constitutional violation here.
Pretty much. They didn't see a federal constitutional requirement to provide counsel in his specific case.
How did it get to the U.S. Supreme Court then?
Well, Betts didn't give up. He filed a petition for certiorari pro se, meaning he filed it himself from prison to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Asking the highest court to review this state court decision.
Right. He argued that this question whether states must provide counsel in all felony cases for indigent defendants was a really important federal constitutional issue that needed a definitive answer. And the Supreme Court agreed. They granted cert.
Okay, so the stage is set. The Supremes take the case. What's the precise legal question they're wrestling with?
The core legal question is, does the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment incorporate the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of counsel, making it mandatory for states to provide lawyers to all poor defendants in any criminal case, or at least in all serious ones?
Or is it something less absolute?
Exactly. Does due process sometimes require counsel, depending on the circumstances, or does it always require it in state felony trials?
And the court, in a 6-3 decision, landed on not always.
That's right. The majority opinion written by Justice Owen Roberts said no. They held that the 14th Amendment doesn't automatically force states to abide by every specific protection listed in the Bill of Rights, including the Sixth Amendment's right to counsel clause.
So no wholesale incorporation of that right onto the states.
Correct. Instead, they focused on this idea of fundamental fairness. Justice Roberts argued that the Due Process Clause guarantees a fair trial, but what constitutes fair isn't a fixed formula. It doesn't necessarily mean a lawyer is required in every single state case.
How did they justify that? Did they look at history?
They did. The majority opinion spent a lot of time looking back at colonial history and state practices around the time the 14th Amendment was adopted.
And what did they find?
They concluded that, historically, most states did not routinely appoint counsel in all non-capital felony cases. So Roberts argued, the framers of the 14th Amendment likely didn't intend to impose such a requirement universally.
So if it wasn't universally required historically, it's not fundamentally required by due process now. Is that the logic?
That was a key part of their reasoning, yes. It led them away from a hard and fast rule and towards a more flexible standard.
Which became known as the...
The totality of the circumstances test, or sometimes called the special circumstances rule.
Okay, break that down. What does totality of the circumstances mean here?
It means that courts had to look at each case individually. To decide if denying counsel violated due process, a court should consider factors like the seriousness and complexity of the crime charged.
Makes sense. Robbery versus, say, petty theft.
Right. Also, the defendant's own capabilities, their age, education, mental state, their experience with court proceedings.
So could this specific person reasonably defend themselves given the situation?
That was the idea. If the case was simple, the defendant seemed reasonably intelligent and capable, and the charges weren't, say, capital, then maybe, just maybe, a trial without a lawyer could still be fundamentally fair under the 14th Amendment.
And applying that test to Smith Betts himself.
The majority looked at Betts' case and said, well, robbery isn't that complicated legally. Betts was of ordinary intelligence. He participated actively in his trial, cross-examining witnesses, presenting his alibi.
They felt he handled it okay, basically.
They essentially concluded that, under the totality of these circumstances, Betts' trial wasn't fundamentally unfair just because he lacked a lawyer. The absence of counsel didn't, in their view, result in a denial of due process in his specific case.
Wow. That creates a system where your right to a lawyer depends very much on a judge's subjective assessment of you and your case.
Exactly. It created a very uncertain case-by-case standard. It put in a heavy burden on the defendant to later prove that their specific circumstances were so special that counsel was required.
Which feels precarious. It's no surprise there was a dissent and a strong one.
Oh, absolutely. Justice Hugo Black wrote a really powerful dissent joined by Justices Douglas and Murphy, and it's famous for laying the groundwork for Gideon.
What was Black's main argument?
Black fundamentally disagreed with the majority's entire approach. He argued passionately that the Sixth Amendment's right to counsel is fundamental and is incorporated by the 14th Amendment, making it applicable to the states. Full stop.
So, not a maybe, not a sometimes, but an always, at least for serious crimes.
Precisely. He saw the right to counsel as essential for a fair trial in any criminal case, state or federal. He famously wrote that the majority's ruling meant that the kind of trial a person gets depends on the amount of money they have.
A direct shot at the inequality inherent in the majority's rule.
Absolutely. He called it a betrayal of equal justice. He emphasized the huge disadvantage an ordinary person faces against a trained prosecutor without a lawyer to guide them through the complex rules of evidence and procedure.
Did he point to other precedents?
Yes. He leaned heavily on Johnson v. Zerbst, the 1938 case where the court had said the Sixth Amendment requires counsel in all federal felony cases.
Right. So the standard was already set for federal courts.
Black essentially asked, if this right is so fundamental that it's required in federal court, why wouldn't it be fundamental enough to apply to state courts through the 14th Amendment? He saw no justification for what he viewed as a double standard.
His logic seems incredibly compelling, especially in hindsight.
It really does. His dissent argued that providing counsel wasn't just about fairness in complex cases. It was about ensuring basic equality before the law for the poor and the ignorant, who are often the most vulnerable in the system.
And that dissent, it didn't win the day in 1942, but it cast a long shadow.
A very long shadow. It provided the intellectual and moral framework for overturning Betts just 21 years later. And fittingly, Justice Black would write the unanimous opinion in Gideon v. Wainwright that did exactly that.
So let's talk about the legacy of Betts during those two decades before Gideon. What was the practical effect?
Well, the practical effect was significant. For 21 years, Betts was the law of the land. It meant states were not constitutionally required to provide lawyers to poor defendants in many, many felony cases.
So countless people went through state trials on serious charges without legal representation.
Yes. Unless they could convince a court later, usually on appeal or habeas corpus, that their specific case involved those special circumstances like extreme complexity or the defendant being illiterate or mentally incompetent, they had no recognized constitutional right to counsel.
That must have led to vastly different outcomes depending on the state or even the judge.
It did. It created a patchwork system. Some states provided counsel more broadly as a matter of state law, but many did not, relying on the Betts standard. It made access to justice heavily dependent on geography and individual judicial discretion.
And then Gideon comes along in 1963 and changes everything.
Completely. Gideon v. Wainwright explicitly overruled Betts. The Gideon court unanimously adopted the view championed by Justice Black in his Betts dissent,
declaring the right to counsel fundamental and essential to a fair trial.
Exactly. And holding that it applies to the states through the 14th Amendment in all felony cases. No more case-by-case special circumstances analysis for felonies. It established a clear, bright-line rule.
So for law students trying to grasp these concepts, Betts is really important for understanding how constitutional interpretation evolves, right?
Absolutely. It's a perfect case study for several key concepts. First, as we mentioned, selective incorporation. Betts represents a time when the court was hesitant to apply the entire Bill of Rights to the states, preferring this case-by-case approach. Gideon shows a shift towards broader incorporation of fundamental rights.
It also shows the court grappling with the meaning of due process itself.
Yes. Is due process a flexible concept that depends on context, like the Betts majority thought? Or does it include certain absolute minimum protections, like the right to a lawyer, as the Gideon court concluded? Betts represents the flexible totality of the circumstances view,
which contrasts sharply with the more rule-based approach in Gideon.
Right. It illustrates that debate between standards versus rules in constitutional law, which pops up all over the place.
And it definitely highlights the federalism tension states' rights versus individual constitutional rights.
For sure. The Betts court showed more deference to state practices, while Gideon asserted a stronger federal constitutional minimum.
And finally, as we've touched on, the power of dissent.
Couldn't be clearer. Justice Black's dissent wasn't just a complaint, it was a roadmap for the future. It shows how dissenting opinions can keep important legal arguments alive and eventually persuade a later court.
It really drives home that constitutional law isn't static. It's a conversation across generations of justices.
Well put.
Okay, so to kind of wrap up our deep dive on Betts v. Brady, we've hit on the fundamental fairness idea, the rejection of automatic incorporation, the problematic totality of circumstances test,
and the crucial role of Justice Black's dissent in foreshadowing and really enabling the eventual ruling in Gideon v. Wainwright.
It's a case that, even though overturned, tells us so much about how our understanding of essential rights like the right to counsel has developed.
Definitely a landmark, even in being overturned.
So a final thought for our listeners to chew on. Betts essentially allowed the guarantee of a fundamental right, the right to a lawyer, to depend on a judge's subjective view of fairness in each specific case.
Right. Is that approach ever truly compatible with the idea of equal justice under law?
Or should fundamental rights have clear, universally applied rules, especially when someone's liberty is at stake, regardless of their ability to pay or navigate the system?
It's a question that still echoes in debates about access to justice today.
Maybe next time we can dive straight into Gideon and see exactly how the court made that decisive shift.
Sounds like a plan.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive.